Good morning, everybody. Dr. Ben Edwards here with You're the Cure. Thank you for joining us today for another great show. We've got an amazing guest. We've had so many amazing guests. And we are getting back to COVID. I've taken a week or two off of talking about COVID-19, but it continues to be the dominating topic. And my passion is for health. And especially when I start to see, I guess I'll call it, propaganda, coercion, encouragement, orders even for people to take a COVID-19 gene therapy injection, especially when these folks being asked to do this are under 18 years old. That encourages me to get a little more aggressive with my education. And we've done a lot as far as early treatment goes with Dr. McCullough and Dr. Bartlett and others. We've talked some about the vaccine. We had Dr. Jessica Rose on recently talk about the adverse events and why isn't anybody talking about these adverse events. We've gone all around this thing. We've had Dr. Botke on earlier, even with his perspective. But there's one perspective we don't have, and that's Dr. David Martin. And if any of y'all are following alternative media, unfortunately, that's where you need to go to even get close to the truth. You probably have heard from Dr. David Martin, as I have. And the things that I learned from him were fascinating, discouraging in a way, but in a way, encouraging. So today's show is going to be intense. We're going to cover a lot of ground. It's going to get technical at times. It's going to be non-medical, more legal at times. But stick with this. I'll try to interpret. Not that Dr. Martin can't just speak to the layperson, but he's very intelligent. He's well-versed in this when it comes to patent law and racketeering and law in general, and international law and all kinds of things. So I read an article this morning. It was a physician from Alberta, Canada. He was working in a rural emergency room hospital. There were three patients that the ER nurse came to tell him he needed to go see. They were elderly. They were struggling with COVID-19. They couldn't breathe. The doctor on shift prior to him didn't give anything but oral steroids. And so this physician gave ivermectin, one dose of ivermectin, gave some inhaled steroids, and gave some antibiotic and some vitamins, some zinc and D and C. These three patients started to do better. Two of them got discharged in a day. The third, who was 95, quit declining, started to plateau and improve. But he got called basically the next day and was put on leave by the head of the Canadian Medical Authority for Alberta. And he was banned from practicing medicine for the rest of the year. And who knows, maybe forever.
Yeah.
And there's continually stories coming out like this that make you scratch your head and think, well, how could this be? How could the American Board of Family Practitioners come out and the American Board of Pediatrics and the American Board of Internal Medicine and basically threaten doctors who question the COVID-19 injection? And the AMA come out and question or tell doctors, don't use ivermectin. But then I look up 31 randomized control trials that show positive benefit with ivermectin. My own clinical experience tells me that. And the clinical experience of dozens and dozens of colleagues of mine that I talk with every day. So these things make you scratch your head. And then an article comes out about Bill Gates deciding to invest $55 million into this little company called Moderna. I think this was in October of 2019 before anyone knew about COVID. And then you scratch your head a little more when you dig a little deeper and you find out that there's this event 201. And so anyways, we're scratching our head a lot these days. David Martin's here. I've asked him to come on here to share what he has discovered and found, but also maybe to answer something to help us to answer and connect some of these dots and how could this be and why something else is going on. And what that doctor in Canada said was something malicious is going on. And we're hardworking West Texas, God-fearing, God-loving, love your neighbor, treat others like you treat yourself, probably help your neighbor out before you'd even help yourself. That's the basic spirit out here in West Texas and probably around the country and even around the world. Humans tend to be loving people that love other humans.
Yeah.
So it's hard for us to believe there can be nefarious things, but we need to open our eyes and dig a little deeper because our kids in particular, and adults obviously are at risk too, but kids, they're relying on us to guide them, lead them, counsel them, and protect them and give them good advice. So we need to dig deeper. We need to keep asking questions. We need to not be scared of being called a conspiracy theorist, which I encourage people to go look up where that term even came from. I'll give you a hint, CIA, but that's another story. So I'm going to quit rambling now and welcome Dr. David Martin to the show. Dr. Martin, thank you for being with us today.
It is an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
Would you mind? You're very welcome. Thank you. Thank you for spending time with us. Would you mind? I was looking kind of at the bio and your website and stuff, but I think it'd be better if you just tell our audience, give them a little background on who you are, how you got to where you are today, and then we'll jump into what you've been teaching everybody lately.
Yeah, well, I've been in this particular narrative since 2002, but in the broader issue around the weaponization of nature and the weaponization of the ecosystem for the very selective and self-interest of a few for actually quite a long time. I started as a frontline triage emergency technician on the border of Nicaragua and Costa Rica in 1987. I've been around patching people up and delivering babies and doing all kinds of things for an exceptionally long time. After getting my graduate degree in physiology at Ball State, I went to the University of Virginia, got my degree in sports medicine, and joined the faculty in radiology and orthopedic surgery in the medical school. And in the early 90s, set up the FDA Clinical Trials Center at the University of Virginia, where we did medical device clinical trials. And I found out very, very quickly that the institutional medicine practice in the United States had nothing to do with the care of humans and had everything to do with the propagation of corporate interest. My specific focus in my early clinical trials were on pain therapy modalities, pulse electromagnetic field therapies. I ran the largest clinical trial that has ever been done in that field, a double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trial, over 40,000 patients across the VA. And also was very involved with, at the time, what was extremely experimental breast cancer detection using radioisotope emitters to identify very early stage breast cancer, typically in young women and specifically in Ashkenazi Jewish women, which is where, as you probably will find out if you do any research, I became exceptionally aware of the fact that the institutional practice of industrial medicine makes its business on maintaining illness, not on helping people regain health. And it was particularly egregious in the case of young Ashkenazi Jewish women, because as you probably know, they have an unusually high incidence of quite fatal breast cancer. We have used for several decades a number of diagnostic approaches that make it impossible to detect in young women. And as a result, there's an acceptable death rate. And I want everybody to hear what I just said. There's an acceptable death rate where young women, typically around their first pregnancy, find out that they're going to die. And that's okay because it's a special population we don't care about. So we actually let them die. And I decided that's not acceptable. So in the mid 90s, I became quite active in trying to blow up a bunch of FDA protocols that preserved the death of people. So I worked with a company out of Texas, Diagnostic Systems Laboratory, on some of the first I-125 assays, iodine-125. It's an isotope that we use to detect proteins in the body. I worked with the development of a number of diagnostic tests to find markers and indicators that would allow us to start detecting things that had been commercially unviable. And once again, pause with that word. People dying because the people who were dying didn't have the money that would make them addicted to a therapy. So we were okay with things like, you know, hyperparathyroidism killing people with a crushing bone cancer that effectively collapses their flat bones. And they ultimately die with their ribs going through their lungs and they bleed out. And that's okay because they're not worth saving because the economics aren't there. These are the kinds of things that I spent the decade of the 90s working on. And then in 1998, I made a mistake. I decided to go to where the root of the problem was, because the root of the problem has been the financialization and the commercialization of health and the commercialization of healthcare, where we stopped caring about the individual. We stopped caring about the well-being of the person, and we started caring about how much could we attach a parasite to a person in the form of prescriptions and supplements and you name it. Just how can we get a person addicted to underwriting the remainder of their life using as many different prescriptions, many different therapies, as many different interventions as possible, not to make them better, but to make them dependent. And it was the convergence of that. And in 1998, when I started MCAM, which is a finance company, we do intangible asset finance, that I found the evil and dark secret, which was the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980, which allowed federal grants, largely in healthcare, to become the commercial windfall, the lottery winning of researchers who were doing the bidding of the federal government and doing the bidding of the pharmaceutical industry. And it turns out that that particular trail was how, in 1999, we found Ralph Baric, who was hired by Anthony Fauci at NIAID to take coronavirus, and I'm quoting from his research now, this is not me spinning it, make a recombinant chimeric replication defective infectious coronavirus. Humans made SARS.
And what year was that again?
1999. And the reason I say that is because we pretend as though, you know, we've got this goofy little theory of a bat and a pangolin walked into a Chinese bar and sneezed. And that's the story we're told. That's what we're supposed to believe. But this thing that we refer to as coronavirus and the thing we refer to as SARS exists only because in 2002, North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Ralph Baric's lab patented the recombinant chimeric coronavirus that could attack human lung epithelium and could attack microvasculature cells and blood in the human body, which up until their invention had not actually happened. You know, if you went back to 1990, Pfizer's very first patent in 1990 on a coronavirus vaccine was for canine coronavirus. Very first work that Ralph Baric did for the decade of the 90s was in cardiomyopathy in rabbits for agriculture purposes. We did not have coronavirus as a function of an assault on the human system until humans weaponized it and patented the weaponization in 2002, which then, as you know, gave rise to the very first SARS outbreak in the fall of 2002, going into the spring of 2003, which we call the Asian SARS outbreak, which is allegedly when all of us were supposed to have met SARS. The only problem is I'd already briefed both law enforcement and intelligence in 2002 on that in the wake of the anthrax outbreak, because most people don't remember late September. In fact, you know, we're within the weeks of when this happened in 2001. When the anthrax scare happened, people pretended like that was some rogue third-party agent. And they didn't pay attention to the fact that this was federally sponsored research where we weaponized a pathogen and then released it on the population. And we did it not because we were trying to terrorize the population alone. We did it so that we could get the PrEP Act. The PrEP Act was the way in which we could essentially declare medical martial law in the country and with impunity give industry indemnity to do anything they want, which includes what they're doing right now, which is killing people using a gene therapy. It is a weaponization of coronavirus.
Mm. Okay. Well, that's a big statement. Let's go back.
It unfortunately has nothing but documented evidence. I mean,
yeah.
I am very careful not to make allegations.
Right.
If we go back and we look at the fact that we adapted coronavirus specifically so it would be, and I'm quoting from them, infectious and replication defective. Now, for the average listener, That's code. So let me unpack the code. Infectious means it actually targets you more effectively. That's we're trying to take a thing and make it stick better. Okay, so that's the infectious half of this. But replication defective is interesting because what we're trying to do is make it hurt you, but not necessarily hurt anybody else. So what we're trying to do is change our model of the way viruses or pathogens work. So it hits you, but it doesn't spread. And that's a very nuanced engineering objective, right? Where I'm trying to make something that harms the person that gets it, but somehow contained so that it doesn't spread. And that's exactly the specification that was built around the SARS coronavirus. And why that's important is because the theory that drove this current alleged pandemic was the Imperial College of London and IHME in Washington and Johns Hopkins University and others who pretended that this was not an engineered pathogen, which has a replication defective property. They pretend that because they need to tell you, oh my God, millions of people are going to die and millions of people are going to fall off the wagon and this is all going to be terrible. And the problem is reality didn't match. We just didn't have the infectious properties that were built into the R-naught principles that were in the Imperial College model. They just didn't show up. And they didn't show up because they can't show up because this is a bioweapon. This is not a virus. This is not a naturally occurring pathogen. This is a bioweapon. It was designed with purpose. And people pretend like these things don't coexist. The only problem is SARS is, in fact, the thing that Ralph Baric and his team at UNC Chapel Hill made.
Okay, so take us from that 1998, 1999, the 2000.
Of 2003, the CDC realized that they finally had landed on something that they had been working towards for a long time. And if you go back and look at the Congressional Record, look at the Federal Register, you'll see that this has been around for a long time. Since 1986, Anthony Fauci's appointment to NIAID was singularly focused on unifying a worldview that says everything needs a vaccine. And the PrEP Act in 2005 is what gave us, you know, the current pandemic, but the Vaccine Injury Acts and the childhood vaccine legislation in 1986, which we all kind of basically at least are aware of, and courtesy of some amazing Texans like Del Bigtree and others, you know, I think more people are aware of that. But if we go back and we look at the 86 Act and the PrEP Act, the reason for doing this was to say that we are going to develop a means by which modifying the human organism through vaccines is the preferred way of dishing out medicine. That is our one hammer, one nail approach to everything. And Anthony Fauci needed, for that to happen, he needed to make sure that the manufacturers got pure indemnity, meaning that they would never be liable for the things that they did. Now, ironically, if an automotive manufacturer said, you know, the brakes work 99% of the time, and you can think about where this goes, right? If an automotive manufacturer said 99% of the time the brakes work, and, you know, randomly every now and then they just won't, and, you know, and a car will careen off the opposite way and go headlong into traffic or go into a school or a parking lot or anything else, no one in their right mind would say, oh yeah, but mostly people get to drive around, so mostly that's okay. We wouldn't do that. You know, if we had anything else that mostly worked except for the fact that it kills you when it doesn't work, we wouldn't tolerate it. But we did with vaccines because there was a financial interest in pretending like a public service was being done. And so what happened in 2003 is CDC recognized that coronavirus was a moneymaker. And it was a moneymaker for two reasons. One is they filed the patent in April of 2003 on SARS coronavirus, the genome. But they also divided their patent filing into two other patent filings, one on the treatment and one on the diagnostics around coronavirus. So essentially what they did in April of 2003 is they locked up the coronavirus industry so that they would control where 100% of the money would flow. And then the NIH, which is part of the CDC apparatus, and FDA, part of the Department of Health and Human Services apparatus, would have 100% market control over telling you when people were going to get sick, how we were going to diagnose them, and then what the treatment for that diagnosis is. And you started this conversation with an interesting anecdotal story. Remember that the reason why we're unallowed to speak about ivermectin, the reason why we're not allowed to talk about zinc or vitamins or anything else, the reason why we can't use the NIH's own references on hydroxychloroquine, which, by the way, they published in a double-blind study in the 2000s after the SARS outbreak. So we can't even use their own data, which is an actual double-blind study that says the hydroxychloroquine worked. We can't do that because under the PREP Act, for liability extension to manufacturers, you can only have the emergency use authorization if there are not clinical alternatives. So by fiat, we are making a statement that says we are going to not have alternatives, not because there aren't alternatives. We are going to not have alternatives because if there are, we can't have the emergency use authorization. And if the emergency use authorization goes away, so does the indemnity protection. And now the manufacturers are liable. So your doctor, the anecdote that you started with, your doctor is refused to allow to practice a known effective treatment. He's refused to be allowed to do that because if we allowed it, 100% of Moderna and 100% of Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca and now Merck with Ridgeback Pharmaceuticals, 100% of their liabilities would be on them. And we are unwilling as a society to actually make industry culpable for its negligence. But this story gets darker, and I'll get to the darker part, because this is not an accident. This is actually willful homicide. This is not some sort of, oops, we didn't see it coming. This is an active program, and I now have had, courtesy of some very lovely people who have had consciences, who have reached out, including one of the most amazing calls I had a couple of weeks ago from the woman who runs the IRB at one of America's leading institutions, where when she asked for the safety data, reviewing the first Moderna protocol and the first Pfizer protocol in humans, asked for the safety data and was told, we are not reviewing animal safety in this case, we're going straight to humans, with a technology that in every animal study from 2010 to 2019 resulted in the death of animals.
Unbelievable. Well, what about, didn't the WHO declare that coronaviruses are done after, sometime after that SARS-1?
Yes.
So shouldn't all this kind of be, have just sort of dwindled away?
Well,
all
these patents. That's a fascinating thing. So in 2008, the World Health Organization said that SARS had been eradicated. We had the uncomfortable outbreak of MERS shortly after that, 4 years later, which kind of makes things feel a little awkward. Because if you've eradicated a thing and then it comes back, it doesn't feel very eradicated. But we like to proclaim victory. I mean, it's, you know, push a flag in the ground and say, I claim this. I claim this for myself. And so, there is a little bit of an awkward oops there. But it's important, Ben, to remind your listeners that in 2015, Peter Daszak, the guy who was money launderer in chief to move funds from the United States to China through EcoHealth Alliance, Peter Daszak, the veterinarian, not the medical doctor that people think he is, that Peter Daszak, the veterinary researcher, he made the statement that we need to, and now I'm quoting from the National Academy of Sciences, February 2016. This is a quote of his presentation in 2015. He said, we need the public to accept a medical countermeasure such as a pan-coronavirus vaccine. We need the media to create the hype, and we need to use that hype to our advantage. Investors will follow when they see profit at the end of the process. That is a quote from the National Academy of Sciences, published in February of 2016 by Peter Daszak, announcing the establishment of the pan-coronavirus vaccine alternative to the failed pan-influenza vaccine that everybody was trying to get people to take. The only problem, as you well know, is that people actually took the influenza vaccine every year and still got the flu. And so weren't sold on how effective it was, for a good reason, because it wasn't effective. And it turns out that because Anthony Fauci and NIAID and Francis Collins at NIH and everybody was obsessed with, we've got to get something where we can get every adult to have to be vaccinated every year, they had to invent a pathogen. And Peter Daszak, and listen, these are not my words, this is a quote from him: we need the media to create the hype, and we need to use that hype to our advantage. Investors will follow if they see profit at the end of the process. If anyone is sitting on the fence about whether this is about profit or public health, why don't we listen to the bank robber in their own words while they're robbing the bank? Why don't we actually stop and stop pretending like this is some sort of divination mystery that we got to get to the bottom of? When you have a bank robber standing with the bag of money on the steps of a bank, brandishing a gun, saying, I just robbed a bank, that's not the appropriate time to go, I wonder if he had mommy issues. I wonder if he had daddy issues. He's a bank robber. We would call him a bank robber. But for follow some the reason, money. We've decided that in this situation, it's too mysterious and it requires too much divination. And that crazy bow tie wearing bald guy, Dave Martin, just is too hard to understand. So let me make it really clear. Profit at the end of the process for a pan coronavirus vaccine in 2015, when the disease itself had been declared eradicated in 2008. If that's too complicated, I can't help.
Yeah, I agree. Neither can I. We got to take a quick break. I think it's a good breaking point. When we come back, we're going to talk about some more of these patents and the way some money moved around and even some legal tussles between some of these companies on giving up some of these parts and pieces of these inventions. So y'all stick with us. Dr. Martin, where's the best place for people to find you if they want to follow you? You have a website or social media. What's the best way?
DavidMartin.world on the web and DavidMartinWorld on YouTube, on Signal, on Telegram, on wherever you can find me. I try to make it easy. And my wife and I have all of our content up at FullyLiveAcademy.com.
Awesome. So everybody go check those out if you want to take a deeper dive into what we're talking about today, and stick with us. We will be right back talking more with Dr. David Martin. I'm Ben Edwards. You're the cure. All right, everybody. We are back with Dr. David Martin. Check out davidmartin.world and all his resources and social media links, I'm sure, on there. We're going to dive right back into this fascinating topic. As Dr. Martin explained in the first half of the show, he started in the 90s, late 90s, discovering some patents regarding coronavirus, regarding the patent of the actual bioweapon technology, but also patents on diagnostics and therapeutics. Is that right, Dr. Martin?
That's correct. Including the CDC's wonderful, wonderful story about their April filing in 2003 of the genome on the SARS coronavirus, which interestingly enough, the patent office rejected as unpatentable in 2005 and again in 2006. And then after the CDC paid a bribe, I referred to it as a bribe because they had to falsify two things. They had to falsify the fact that they had timely responded to the patent office, which is a violation of the law. And they had to also pay to keep some of their information about this thing secret, also a violation of the law. That's why I refer to it as a bribe. They'll call it a fee, but they paid a fee and had the patent office backdate their submission so that they could actually wind up getting the twice rejected patent on SARS coronavirus finally issued. And when they were called to task for the issuance of that patent, Ben, it was actually funny. They said that the reason why they got it was so the public could do research on it. Now, the funny thing is, the reason why the patent office twice ruled that it was invalid was because it was already in the public domain where people could have done any amount of research on it they wanted to do. But the CDC lied to the public, lied to the patent office, lied to the federal government. And as late as October of 2020, and it's important for us to point this out, as late as October of 2020, when the Congressional Budget Office asked the National Institutes of Health to be accountable for the patents that they hold that are generating money, which may lead to conflicts of interest. Sound like something we should probably know about?
Maybe.
These patents were never disclosed to Congress. So in addition to lying all the way through the beginning of this thing, they lied during the pandemic. They lied about their interest in coronavirus. This thing, you know, once again, the best thing about my position is having watched this thing unfold since 1999 and watching all the 4,000 plus patents that have been filed specifically on SARS coronavirus, including 117 specifically on what was called novel in February of 2020, which was not novel. Everything about the quote novel coronavirus was published in 2016. So there's nothing novel about anything. The fact of the matter is, you know, we've been tracking this thing, and it turns out that there are over 4,000 patents, 4,000 commercial interests in making sure that the public of the United States and the world are subject to mercantile gain around the weaponization of coronavirus.
Unbelievable. And share with the audience, we kind of didn't do this at the top, on how did you become such a knowledgeable person, or I'd say expert on patents? Talk about your company or how you got into patents.
If you go back to 1998, and we need to go back a little further, 1780s, the only property right that's granted to every American under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution is the right to intellectual property. It's the right that every citizen has. It's the only property right we have by constitutional right, which is kind of an important thing. And in 1998, my company, MCAM, was set up to be the underwriter for using intangible assets, patents, copyrights, trademarks, recordings, artwork, whatever else, as collateral for bank lending. To do that, we became the first, the U.S., and then in a few short years, the global underwriter of all intangible asset underwriting for all financial institutions worldwide. And so to this day, we are the only underwriter of every intangible asset that moves on this planet. To do that, we had to have systems and we had to have all kinds of stuff. I invented a process called linguistic genomics, which allows us to do the title searches on whether your idea is in fact unique or whether it's been seen somewhere else on Earth before. Our databases go back to the 1600s. So pretty much anything that moves for the last 400 years, we have in our databases to find out whether what you say is your new and unique idea is new or unique. But the other thing we find is we find violations of laws, because we happen to code into our system the kinds of things that would be interesting flags to detect for law enforcement and for intelligence reasons and for a whole bunch of other things. So we code a number of triggers which allow us to flag things of interest. I'll give you some examples. Obviously, things like ciprofloxacin, the treatment for anthrax. We were very interested to find out that the Department of Army was buying 300 million doses of ciprofloxacin in May of 2001. And you heard what I just said. In May of 2001, when the anthrax outbreak took place in September of 2001.
Mm-hmm. Interesting coincidence.
Doesn't that sound fascinating that we would be doing that for a disease that is typically associated with hide tanners in India? That's who gets anthrax, hide tanners. Now, in West Texas, Ben, you probably have one or two anthrax cases, because anybody dealing with any animal hides is more likely than not, you know, going to get some anthrax exposure. But not 300 million doses worth. That's not, you know, nobody's going to go through 300 million doses. But we also found interesting things like conotoxins. Most of us don't know what those are, but off the coast of the islands in the Philippines and various parts of the South Pacific, there are little shellfish that have little barbs in them. And those little barbs have a very, very significant myotoxin. It's actually a paralytic agent, which if you get hit by it, will kill you in about 20 or 30 seconds. but we were very interested in the fact that a lot of these conotoxins were being patented. Now, it turns out that some of their patenting activities were by Medtronic. When you ask the question, Medtronic, why would Medtronic be patenting a lethal myotoxin and a paralytic agent from a shellfish in the Philippines? Well, the reason was actually a really good reason. It turns out that when you're putting electrodes in the heart, when you install a pacemaker in the heart, one of the things you want to do is you want to be able to still a part of the heart without stopping the whole thing. So you want to increase the overall safety of a procedure. And so what they were doing was they were experimenting with whether or not we could use very small amounts of this shellfish toxin, put it on a part of the myocardium, get that particular part of the heart to stop for a moment, put the electrode in, and then get it to restart so that we didn't have to take the whole heart offline. And that's a beautiful experiment where somebody's using a natural phenomenon to do a really, like, holy cow, creative thing. Like, when I read those, you know, my first thought was, oh, it's illegal to do conotoxin. That's one of the biological weapons that's been on a restricted list for a long time. But then you read about what they're doing, and I think both of us would agree that's a pretty creative idea. If you can take a very tiny amount of a thing that in a large amount would kill you, but if you can take a small amount of it and you can apply that to the heart and actually increase the safety of a cardiac procedure, what a great idea. And so our business was about flagging things to try to understand what people were doing with them. And so, you know, you can go back in the public record. I was the first to audit the U.S. Patent Office in 1786. I very famously testified in Congress that a third of all the patents in the United States were functional forgeries. At one of my congressional testimonies, that went over like a lead balloon, but it unfortunately had the inconvenience of being true. What we then found out through the subsequent decade was that over 50% of patents are in fact invalid. But I led the entire patent quality reform in the United States and in Europe. And so by now, it would be safe to say that I'm probably, as a living person, among one of the few people that has done more to shape patent law and its use in finance than probably anybody in the history since Jefferson wrote first patent examination on potash in the 1780s.
So, yeah, for sure. I would call you the expert. So I've heard you in other interviews use the word racketeering.
Yes.
And I think even conspiracy possibly, but yeah, connect some dots.
Conspiracy is a legal term, and it's important that we understand that the legal construct of conspiracy has been around in our legal system for as long as this country has been around. Conspiracy is when two or more people get together to plan an illegal act. That's what a conspiracy is. And, you know, unfortunately, as you alluded to at the beginning of the show, conspiracy theory was invented to marginalize and put people into some very, very unusual positions. Ironically, the CIA, although many times attributed as being the people who came up with the idea of conspiracy theory, actually themselves took the idea from someone else. Because the first time it was used in references was when a group of psychologists and psychiatrists used it to describe what they thought were radical theories about psychotherapy back in the turn of the last century. So it's fascinating. But in each one of these, conspiracy is a legal doctrine. It's when you get together to plan an illegal action. Now, the reason why racketeering and conspiracy is so important in this case is, as I said, and let's remember Peter Daszak's quote. Remember this quote. Right? We need the public to accept a medical countermeasure for a pan-coronavirus vaccine when there's no coronavirus. So we need a vaccine for a thing that doesn't exist. Number one. So that is a criminal conspiracy. He's doing it in public, and he's doing it with people who are funded to build the thing that he's talking about. This is not an open market competition, which is the way free markets work. So the Sherman and the Clayton Act, which are our antitrust laws in this country, are specifically written so that you cannot in private create an enterprise where you have done what's called market allocation. And what that means is you're not letting the free market do anything. You're actually saying, I'm going to financially incentivize the winner and I'm going to pick everybody else to be the loser, and the customer loses in the end. That's what racketeering and you know, the whole market allocation problem is in antitrust laws. And then it gets worse. you have a thing called interlocking directorates. Now, that was very famous in 1911. Everybody in America knew what that was in 1911, because the Peugeot Commission, which did the investigation that ultimately gave rise to the Federal Reserve, but the Peugeot Commission did a study on the fact that the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and all these families all seemed to be part of the oil and the banking and the insurance and the rail. And like, they all seemed to be on each other's boards and they all seemed to be knowing what each other was doing. And the reason why that was a crime was because you could fix prices without having public awareness. You know, you could wink, wink, nod, nod. Hey, I'm going to charge you a little less to move your oil if you buy my rail cars. And, you know, those are unfair trade practices. And we have laws in the United States that make it illegal to do that. Well, Anthony Fauci, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's Dr. Bill Elias, and the Chinese Center for Disease Control, Dr. Gao, all sit on a board called the World at Risk Global Pandemic Monitoring Board. That board is a board of directors, which actually plans things like the World at Risk scenario in September of 2019, which said that in the period from September of 2019 to September 2020, we were going to do, and I quote, a worldwide exercise in the simulation of a release of a respiratory pathogen to build the public's acceptance of a universal vaccine. Now, when you have co-conspiring parties, that's not me hypothesizing anything. When you have co-conspiring parties who have financial interests that are not being disclosed sitting on the same board, that is a prima facie violation of the antitrust laws of the United States. That is what the organized crime rackets in the 1920s, the mafia, that's what they did. This is a mafia style program. The difference is it's Fauci's Brooklyn mob. It's not Capone's Chicago mob. But the only difference is where the mob came from. The fundamentals have not changed. And then the worst piece, which is the last piece that the public actually should be aware of, is price fixing. You know how the decision was made on how to price the injection, not based on how much it costs to do the R&D, not based on how much it costs to do something else. It was priced off of the illusion, and this is the comedy of it. It was priced off the illusion that it saves 3 days in hospital. Therefore, the value of the vaccine is actually the average cost of hospitalization times three, and that's now the value of the vaccine, right? That's collusion. That's price fixing, that's market manipulation, that's all kinds of other things. And that's here in the US. Forget the fact that we have like Justin Trudeau in Canada, who's bought 10 times more vaccines than there are Canadians, 10 times more. Okay. And nobody asks the question, why is it that British Columbia seems so obsessed about making sure this vaccine succeeds? Well, here's the answer, people. If you want to know why, Acuitas Pharmaceuticals, which is from the University of British Columbia, is the inventor of the lipid nanoparticle that is the core of the Moderna and the Pfizer shot. Every time a shot gets sold, a royalty gets paid to British Columbia. So the reason why everybody's mystified by, oh, how is Canada so draconian in their vaccine measures? Well, it's not a mystery. Trudeau has fixed and colluded a price. And then he over-procured by 10 times the number of vaccines required to vaccinate every Canadian. He has over-procured so that he can do what? He can pocket money. That is racketeering. That's price fixing. Those are felony violations. That's 99-year prison terms per violation. And Anthony Fauci, Justin Trudeau, Francis Collins, Ralph Barrick, these guys have 8 felonies that are admitted to in public records, and nobody is prosecuting.
Unbelievable. And am I correct that if these felonies were prosecuted and convicted, that would open up from a liability standpoint, because otherwise these companies, Moderna, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, they're protected by the PrEP Act, right?
Yeah, so there's a beautiful opinion that was done most recently updated in April of 2020, which made it abundantly clear that under the Department of Justice prosecution guidelines, that the emergency use authorization is absolute with one exception. And the one exception is if the emergency was predicated on a felony act by a public official. And all we need is one. We need the perp walk, the Dashik, the Fauci, the Francis Collins, the Ralph Barrick. We need one perp walk. And all of a sudden, Pfizer and Moderna and AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson are now liable for every illness, every injury, and every death of every injection that they've done. And if that doesn't get somebody somewhere to get off their duff and do something right, I don't know what would. Because it turns out that this whole thing goes away in one day. Goes away in one day. If one law enforcement officer does his or her job.
And do you care to speculate on why one law enforcement officer so far has not done that?
Well, I wish I wasn't speculating. I've had too many interactions with too many of them very recently with your very own Ken Paxton in Texas, where I provided information to his office. The head of legal prosecution for his office was scheduled to meet with me Wednesday, 2 weeks ago. I was on my way to the meeting when I got a phone call saying that he suddenly couldn't meet with me. Could I come at 10 o'clock on Thursday morning? And I was flying out of Austin at midday. So I said, yes, I'll come at 10. And I got there and walked into his office. And he came out to meet me and he said, who are you and why are you here? And I said, I'm Dr. David Martin. I'm your 10 o'clock meeting. He goes, I don't know who you are and I don't know why you're here. I don't have any meeting. Apparently, somebody had gotten to the attorney general between Tuesday when I flew into Austin, Wednesday when I was supposed to have the meeting, and Thursday when I showed up. I wound up having a meeting with a young staff attorney, spent about 30 minutes with him talking about employment law and face mask litigation, and made the uncomfortable observation after telling him that there was a Texas administrative code that is the equivalent of the Federal Trade Commission Deceptive Medical Practices Act, which, for those of you not familiar with it, is a rule that says that you cannot promote anything to treat, diagnose, or cure a disease if you don't have at least two clinical studies to prove the thing. And it turns out that I asked this guy, who is allegedly Texas front man in doing face mask litigation, I said, are you familiar with the C.R. McIntyre study, which is the only study ever done in a controlled clinical trial on face masks, which showed that after 3 years of observational studies in this study, that people wearing face masks had an increase in influenza-linked illness. You heard me say that right. They had an increase in influenza-linked illness. And I said, you're clearly going to use that in your litigation, right? He said, I'm not familiar with the study. I said, well, you at least know that the Texas Administrative Code has a Deceptive Medical Practices Act like the Federal Trade Commission Act. He goes, yeah, this is really not about the law. It's about politics. Now, that coming from your attorney general's office. When we have an attorney general's office that says that this is about politics and not the law, what we were just told is that the three co-equal branches of government have sold out, because the reason why we have checks and balances is, in fact, to make sure that we don't allow one section of government to overrun its abilities by making sure another one holds it accountable. What I was told in Ken Paxton's Justice Department or Attorney General office, right next to the Capitol in Austin, Texas, what I was told was this was about politics. This was not about the law. And I was talking to the guy who's supposed to be Texas lawman, who didn't know he had an administrative code in Texas, which was equivalent to the Federal Trade Commission Act. Now, why, as a Virginian, would I need to tell somebody that the Texas Administrative Code sections, you know, and I gave him the sections, I gave him everything. Why would I need to tell him that? And all I could remember is that it did take a Virginian to go to Texas to actually get the state of Texas going in the first place. So thank you, Sam Houston.
Well, thank you, David Martin, for coming to Texas and encouraging the truth to prevail. So if this is all about politics, that would lead me to the conclusion that the lobbyists who fund the politicians are probably going to be very influential.
Yes.
In the direction that our decisions in our country is going to go.
Yep. And listen, we've known this for a long time. Pharma, as a professional lobbying organization, pharma is the largest lobbying organization in America. And by quite a margin. It used to be defense and oil and tobacco had a lot of money that went into these things. Pharma has eclipsed them all. So we actually know who's paying the bills. And we know that right now, everybody wakes up knowing which way they salute. And until someone in the public service has a conscience that says that I'm willing to draw a line under, you know what, I was willing to see past this for favoritism, but I'm not willing to have murder on my hand. It's not until that reality settles into somebody where some person of conscience is going to go, yeah, I didn't sign up for that.
Yeah. Well, in the few minutes, we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. I want to play devil's advocate. So, you know, maybe Daszak and Fauci and these guys, you know, maybe they're not like me. Maybe they don't believe in a creator that designed an amazing immune system and designed all this. And, you know, for the benefit of humanity, they're just going to use their amazing intelligence and their technology and their experience to try to develop some things that maybe down the road can be useful for human beings. You know, who knows? Maybe a coronavirus is just going to wildly come out of a bat cave somewhere. Maybe in the future. So let's get ahead of the game. Let's do some gain of function. Let's get in the lab and just start manipulating a bunch of stuff and, you know, for the benefit of humanity.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if you're really, really a coincidence theorist, you could go for that. But if that thing proves to be harmful, to be deadly, and then we just kind of ride that off to, oh, well, that's the acceptable death rate for the advancement of medicine and the advancement of technology. That's, you know, again, this is being way over devil's advocate. That's the bottom line for me is people are being harmed and in most cases not being given a choice. I mean, yeah, you have a choice sort of, but you'll be fired. I mean, it's unbelievable that from an adverse reaction standpoint, the refusal to discuss or talk about this had a young kid come in who was injured, basically fell asleep 48 hours after the injection, and sleeps 22 hours out of 24 now every single day for over 40 days. And the doctor said it's not from the injection. And this blindness, this refusal to see, this refusal to talk about, there's no one that's being held accountable. So in the few minutes we have left, do you have comments on that?
Well, so we've had throughout our history the kind of buyer's remorse, the investigator's regret. You know, we have the story of Oppenheimer, who allegedly drove past military guards every day on his way into the Manhattan Project and had no idea he was building a bomb. You know, I'm sorry. I'm an intelligent person. If I'm going past barbed wire and armed guards and military police, and I don't think it might have military applications, I'm sorry, I don't buy that. I don't buy that a person like Peter Daszak innocently did a thing when he said, we need media to create the hype and we need to use that hype to our advantage. That's not a person who is just expediently making a decision in an expedient moment of, you know, kind of a rash thing. That is premeditation, and it's premeditated murder. That's what it is. And part of, I think, where most of us who find ourselves on the, what I would call the more humane or the more charitable side of a spectrum about humanity, we actually try to get into the mind of the sociopath and at least satisfy ourselves that we can come up with an explanation other than the one that is the one that's right in front of our face, which is these are criminals. And I think that sometimes part of the challenge and been part of the reason for conversations like this is I think we must get to a place where we understand that it is not judgment of a person to say their act is criminal. It is, in fact, discernment of what they've done. And the fact is, by the way, in September of 2019, a very chilling report was made by Anthony Fauci, where he reported on a HIV vaccine trial that was conducted, and in his own words, on three continents. He didn't specify where they were. The estimates are that there was as many as 50,000 people involved in this, and his only report is the trial didn't work. I don't know how you go through your day, but I can't take 50,000 people and just go, oops. I can't do that. I don't have a place in my brain where I have calloused my soul enough to come up with any theory for any reason that says, well, that's an acceptable death rate in the progress of science. I can't do that. And I think that we have to have the moral fortitude of saying there is wrong that is being done. And this is not Dave Martin's opinion. This is an objective wrong. And it is objectively wrong because the perpetrators have all also had to have the same fingerprint, which now they've admitted to in public, which is they lied, a noble lie. They lied to the public to get the public to do a thing that they knew wasn't in the public's interest, because in fact, it was in their interest. You can't wiggle your way out of that. There's no moral, there's no moral justification. There's no meta level rationale that says that it is okay to harm and maim and kill another human being to advance your belief. We have in this country, courtesy of Thomas Jefferson and George Mason, we have the statutes of religious freedom that were enshrined in our founding documents and then ultimately enshrined in the Bill of Rights, which says that the state cannot force a belief on anyone. Vaccine is a belief. It has never been science. It never will be science. It's a belief. And is a belief that says that the human is amplified in their living experience by having a pathogen injected into them. That's a belief. And this country was founded on a principle that says the state cannot force a belief on anyone for any reason. And it's time we start having the right conversation. This is not science. This is religion. And Anthony Fauci is the Pope of that religion. And we need to call it what it is, and we need to stop pretending that there's a moral justification for sending our children into harm and into death, allegedly for the public interest of the delusions of a mad set of scientists. That's never going to be acceptable.
Amen. Well said. And we've been preaching that here for a while. It is a belief system. It's a religion of scientism.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. David Martin. Our hour is up. I know we could go on and on. I know you've spent many hours talking to many people. Thank you for spending one more with one more interviewer for the benefit of our audience. So we really appreciate your hard work. I know it's not easy to do these things and to stand up against these people and this amount of money and power. So it takes courage and commitment to your fellow human being. So thank you for all you're doing.
It is an honor, and I'm glad that we had a chance to speak, and I look forward to when we see each other in the flesh.
Amen. Me too. Everybody, davidmartin.world is the website. Follow him there. Follow his social media. He and his wife are doing great work. And come back here next week. We'll have another great show on You're the Cure. We will have this recorded and archived on our website, veritasmedical.com. Go check that out. Thank you all for joining us today. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.